Backseat Producers, episode 233, Dog Day Afternoon. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And this is Joe.
We are the Backseat Producers. Welcome.
It's a hot, hot day in St. Louis.
It is warm in St. Louis. So I've been checking the weather, and I've got this weather app on my phone. And I have it set for St. Louis, my hometown here in Illinois, and Vegas, because we're going in a couple weeks. Today at like 1 in the afternoon, it was like 84 in St. Louis, 83 here, and 90 in Vegas. Tomorrow's forecast, in St. Louis it was 106. It was 106, 104 here, or no, I'm sorry, 103 here, and 105 in Vegas. It was 1 degree warmer in St. Louis for the forecast tomorrow than Vegas.
You'll feel right at home.
And at 10 o'clock last night, it was 104 when Charles was doing his security duty in Texas. 104.
Wow.
10 o'clock at night. It's like, welcome to Texas.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very big myth that it doesn't cools off in the evening. It don't. No, it just stays hot.
Well, it depends on where it is.
He's in Fort Hood, so clean.
Okay.
It's like, was it a dry heat?
Yeah, so it's warm. I think Dog Day Afternoon kind of
isn't
appropriate.
That a good thing? Well, that was our whole theme. Our whole sequence was heat.
I would have realized the date, because the movie starts showing the date, and it shows it, I think it's August 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
It would be the 40th anniversary of the event. Later this summer is the 40th anniversary of the event, the story that's told in Dog Day Afternoon.
I'll have to go back and look, because I know we should be hitting the anniversary, or close to the anniversary, for Do the Right Thing, too.
Coming
up on 25 years.
Yeah. So, before we get started, there was a documentary that I watched this past weekend. I watched part of it before, and I finally sat down and watched the whole thing. It's called The Other F Word. Did I mention that?
No. Is it good?
Yeah, it was really good. It's a documentary, and Morgan Spurlock is one of the producers. I don't think he really had anything to do with the filming of it, but he might have been kind of a benefactor to it. It's interviewing a bunch of guys who used to be or still are punk rock musicians about fatherhood.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it is really
cool.
Is it on
Netflix?
I don't know if it's on Netflix. I saw it on Stars. But it might be on Netflix, because sometimes that star stuff is on
still
Netflix.
There.
Yeah, but it's called The Other F Word. It's really good. And there was parts of it that kind of made you laugh, because these are punk rock guys.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And then there was some pretty heartbreaking stories too. One guy lost his son to a car accident, and just his reaction was just so visceral, even though it had happened years before. Really good stuff. I think one of the funniest things was this guy was talking about how he went to his daughter's preschool, and he was like volunteering to help out with something at the preschool, and he shows up and he's helping out, and he realizes all these other parents are staring, like flat out staring at him. And he's like, what's going on? He's like, I know I'm kind of different. You know, I dress alternative. And he looks down and he's wearing a shirt that says, fuck the police.
Whoops.
So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. So it's pretty good. I definitely recommend it. It's cool to see these guys, that are in just such a different environment. Cause like one guy's on tour for months at a time, and he comes back to his little girls. You know, he's completely different when he's at home. And the one guy said, you know, it's, you know, when we were in our 20s, you know, we were railing against the system. We were fighting the man. We were, you know, we wanted to tear down the system. And
now then, we are the system.
Well, he said, then, you know, you get a little older and you get married and you have kids and you need diapers and you need health care and you need to go to the hospital and you realize you rely on that system.
Or at least certain parts of it.
Yeah.
Well, and you're going to be thinking about retirement and all those other things too.
Right. Well, and that's what they said. You know,
so I have to come back.
We never planned on living this long, let alone.
You know, yeah, life happens when maturing. You make another plan.
Yeah. It's good. It's worth watching.
There's I've been watching a lot of documentaries lately, and to kind of piggyback on that, there's a documentary on looking at Pearl Jam 20 years later. It's on PBS.
Oh, really?
That's really good, too. And it talks about kind of the evolution of not only the band, but grunge music and the impact of people with, and why they're still together. It's long. It was longer than I thought, but it was really good too.
I have to look for
and
that
it's
one.
On like via the free app. It's on the PBS app.
Cool.
And then I watched The Woodsman too, which was it's about a family of artists, and Francesca Woodsman was a photographer that killed herself and now found all this fame. Much later, and a lot of her work is actually was way ahead of its time, and people are mimicking it now. But that one was hard to watch because they talk about her suicide, but you have these two. Her parents are both artists, and talking about the creative process and the impact. And her brother, who's an artist in his own right, is kind of left because everything was always about Francesca because she was the more gifted or the special one. He keeps calling her. She was special.
Oh, wow.
He's in living in her shadow all the time.
Yeah, and he does multimedia kind of stuff, and they don't really elaborate too much on it, other than you see he has a son, he has a wife, and, you know, he seems happy, where she was always tortured by her art.
Yeah,
but it was good. But the Pearl Jam one, I really enjoyed that.
I'll have to check that out. I have enjoyed Pearl Jam on and off. I kind of stopped following them after, like, their second album. But, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of came to them really late. I wasn't into them when they first came out. I don't know if that was because I had a kid and we were doing other stuff and just not current.
I was in college.
I really liked Eddie Vedder. So, and I liked a lot of his new stuff. So that's where I kind of went back and started listening to the old stuff. And kind of, that's been like the last 10 years.
Yeah, I was at U of I when Pearl Jam's 10 came out. And I remember going into one of the record shops there, which the record shops there were like nothing, even at the time, they were like nothing anywhere else, you know. It's like you walked in, and this was in 91, 92, and there was a girl with a purple stripe in her hair. And it was like, whoa, that's awesome, you know, because, I mean, you just didn't see that. You know, it just wasn't common at all. And the folks there were really cool. I was buying a Mother Love Bone. Was it? No, I bought Temple of the Dog. And this guy explained to me, like, the all the bagats that took place to get to Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and Nirvana.
This documentary kind of covers that.
Sort of like a real life version of High Fidelity.
As far as the venue. Yeah, the venue was definitely like that. But it was cool because he told me how, I can't remember the guy's name. I think it was Andrew Wood. He was the lead singer. And he died of a heroin overdose. And, as a tribute, his former band and members of Soundgarden got together and jammed, and they were just going to do a couple of songs. And they made a whole album, and they called in a session singer, this guy they knew, to do some background stuff. And he actually ended up doing some lead on a few of the songs because they ended up making a whole album over the course of like a weekend.
Whoa.
And
so that it helps when lightning strikes. It goes all the way.
That album was the Temple of the Dog disc. then he joined the other members of the band that was Mother Love Bone, and that group, with Eddie Vedder as the lead singer, is Pearl Jam.
Right. Well, then they added the drummer from Soundgarden when they fell apart.
Yeah.
And they talk a lot about that death, because he was in the hospital on life support. And so all of the guys
I didn't know that part of it.
And he was apparently a very charismatic character, and you could kind of tell ahead of his time just from the video footage.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting. And also they talk a lot about just Eddie Vedder and his evolution into Eddie Vedder. He was very, very shy, not really out there, and he kind of went a little on the crazy side and he's kind of calmed. And it's really kind of neat. And they talk about, you know, why that band is still together and why they're so solid.
That's cool.
Compared to other bands.
Yeah.
And they go through and talked about when they fought Ticketmaster and how that kind of fell apart, but yet, you know, was the right thing to do.
Yeah. When they did their
their
experiment of recording every concert and releasing the CD of every concert that they did on tour,
You know what's funny, though? People are doing that now. I saw a Band of Heathens, and you, for $10, you could buy a thumb drive of the performance, and they gave it to you at the end of the concert before you went home.
The band I listened to, Marillion, did that.
Oh, it's awesome.
They were the first ones to do it, that if you waited around 2 hours after the show, they were selling, and I think it was, no, it was CDs. They were CDs of the performance you had just listened to. And this was 15 years ago. I mean, this was when it was like, well, I will wait 2 hours for a CD of the concert. that was amazing technology, you know, at the time.
Yeah. And all started by the Grateful Dead with all their tapers.
Yeah.
Who allowed everybody to plug into their soundboard and create the big trading network that was the Grateful Dead.
Yeah. It's really cool that they did that.
Oh, yeah, they were so bloody far ahead of their time.
Yeah, that's what gave them their popularity, mm-hmm. really.
Well, and I think that that's kind of with all the technological advances, I think that that's now what we're starting to see is, you know, forget record companies. A lot of the bands are just taking it upon themselves, self-promoting, mm-hmm. self-recording.
Right. Well, it's so easy and frictionless now. I mean, you can be your own, you can hire your own sound engineer or be your own sound engineer. It's, the equipment's not all that expensive it isn't that hard to do.
And I think with Twitter and all these other things, it's really easy to create kind of I think they call them street teams.
Oh, yeah.
You can actually market to your fans directly and have it kind of go viral. And the smarter mm-hmm. bands are taking control over those things. And it's neat to see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The last Marillion album, this Marillion album, both of them were crowdsourced. They took pre-orders before they ever started recording.
Mm-hmm.
It paid for all the studio time. It paid for all of that.
Have all the production costs already covered before you walk in.
At one point, and this was in the mid-90s, I want to say, their fans asked them, what would it take for you to tour the States? And they said, we need to be guaranteed at least $10,000. I think it was $10,000 or some. It was some number. We need this much starting capital to guarantee us returns and so that we won't go broke. Basically,
right. All your pre-production costs covered.
The fans raised $30,000
and just gave it to Kickstarter.
Yeah, it was pre-Kickstarter. It was just the fans got together within the fan club network and
we
that.
Want this, so we're willing to pay for it.
So that they and what's cool is that they did it so that they could tour North America.
Mm-hmm.
They had people from Australia, Brazil, Argentina, all over the Africas, Asia, all donating to this fund. And you know, they interviewed some of the fans. They were like, "Why did you donate?" When you knew this was for North America. And their thought was, we love this music so much, we want to be able to make sure that they can support it. And if they can get to North America, if they can get to America and Canada, and get big and break through in that market, that means we get a better shot at them. They'll never tour here.
Yeah.
But if they can get big, they might. They just might. Well, and that was really neat. Yeah. Yeah. So, I guess we should probably talk about the movie we were supposed to talk about.
Oh, let's go.
All right, so Dog Day Afternoon. High-level thoughts. Daryl, what'd you
think? Well, it's been a long time since I've seen this movie. It's kind of refreshing to watch it one more time. Al Pacino just dominates. I mean, did some more research after watching the movie, did a little more research on the director, Sidney Lumet, and Al Pacino and their relationship and how this movie came to be. And it's very still watchable, you know, all these years later. I mean, you sit back and you just let the story unfold ahead of you. And it's kind of fun to watch, you know, Pacino sit there and just dominate the entire performance. And you can see why he gains the accolades he does. And this was like this, what, the movie he made right, this character was the one after Godfather.
Yeah, I agree. I think he brought the character of Sonny to almost heroic kind of stature. And I liked, and I thought it was actually, it held up the conflict between the general people and populace and I don't even want to call him the man. But
it's the anti-establishment theme.
The establishment, yeah. And I thought that was, that still really held up, and I think it makes the movie higher quality, and I think that's why it takes, it has its place in the top films of all time. And I think it's actually relevant now when you look at things like, the Occupy movement and this whole, structure.
There's one great little scene in there where Sonny is being interviewed by the TV reporter, and he asks him, well, couldn't you get a job anywhere else? And he comes back, at what rate? How much do you make? Do you think I could make it as a these bank tellers make?
Well, and it's I don't have a union card. Well, yeah. Do non-union work.
Yeah, for what?
Well, and probably my favorite... And it's so Al Pacino, is he gets off the phone with his female wife.
Yes.
You know, and just the look on his face with his head in his hands. I just like, I mean, that anybody can relate to that, you know, just where you just keep getting kicked.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's, you know.
Yes, here I am in the middle of a bank robbery and my wife is chewing me out over her problem. Hey, I got the problem
and his
here.
His mom shows up. I mean, it's just like this one thing after another.
Yes, one huge dysfunctional family just keeps going and going and going. He's got a transgender girlfriend who's giving him grief. He's got his wife who's crying about how she feels, and then his mom comes on and saying, oh, you were such a cute baby, you're such a disappointment now. Gee, throw some more encouragement my way here.
I think a lot of people can relate to that. Mm-hmm. Particularly this whole guilt piece, you know, that you're here, you're trying your hardest to like succeed and to
I'm trying to rob a bank here, everybody. Yeah. Give me a break.
Yeah, leave me alone.
Yeah, let me get this done.
You know, and
it's the one thing in my life I've done right.
But then he doesn't. I mean, he starts off. I mean, he couldn't even get the gun out of the box.
And the one guy they had with him flakes out in the first 5 minutes. And you know, this is like, okay, what else can go wrong? Well, a lot more. Yeah.
So, before we get too much farther, as much as I hate prologues, I think this movie almost could have stood for one just to make it a little more timeless, because part of the background of the movie was the time and what happened at Attica, the Attica prison riots played into it, but they didn't tell you much about it. Seemed like you know this.
Well, given the time frame that this movie came out, that would have still been in the head. Pretty much in everybody's mind already.
Yes, and that's true. But 40 years later, I had to go look it up because I didn't remember. I mean, I knew it was a violent
prison
struggle.
Riot, yeah.
I didn't even really know it was a prison riot. I knew it was some kind of violent.
Race-related.
Yeah, I mean, I did the research and it was like, oh, now I understand exactly why all this ties together. So I do think there is a little bit lost in translation. If you go into this movie cold, there are a few things that you don't, if you're not aware of, if you weren't, you know, if you don't know the time period, if you don't know about Attica, you get it, but you don't really know what he was, what kind of buttons he was pushing.
Yeah, basically. And also that one scene has been used in other movies the same way.
It is a rather
right. interesting cliche. Yeah.
But what is
Which
the reference?
Is even funnier though, because it's a cliche even when he starts it. I mean, mm-hmm. And that's what Lumet does so well. Is this whole concept, and it's even more true today, that whole concept of, you know, being a celebrity because you're on the news and mm-hmm. stuff.
You're famous because you are famous.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. All right, so the acting. So Pacino, I mean.
Yeah, but also his other co-actors.
He was awesome.
Who was the guy who played Leon?
Chris Sarandon.
Oh, Chris Sarandon, yes. Awesome. Susan Sarandon's.
I loved him.
I tweeted, like, the day after I watched the movie, Chris Sarandon played the best gay transvestite Jewish mother I've ever seen. Because he was, the way he's,
the arms. Oh
my God,
was
he was
dying.
Playing, he was channeling a Jewish mother. And he was
I killed myself to get away from you, you're such a disappointment.
It was also
the way he did that.
It was so dramatic.
Yes.
Well, and I liked Sal.
Sal was great.
Understated, and but yet, you know, you could tell
so trusting and.
But yet, so simple.
Yeah.
You know, like the line of I want to go to Montana. You know, yeah. Just like
we have to go to another. We have to go to another country. I want to go to Montana. Whoa! Yeah.
You know? And then also when one of the bank tellers there is getting ready to smoke a cigarette, he's all concerned, like, you shouldn't do that to
your temple. God's temple.
I mean, yeah, I robbed banks, but I do take care of myself.
Well, and he had been in prison.
Yes.
Because he's like, I can't go back. And so you're like, all right, your body's your temple, but you've been in prison.
It was interesting how they, through the course of the movie, they had little digs to pieces of social relevance that are still valid.
A lot.
The smoking, when the one teller gets a phone call from her husband, it's like, how long are we going to be? He wants to know when you come home. Well, you're going to have to heat up your own dinner.
Well, and then she's on the phone again talking about the baby.
Yeah. I thought that was really great.
The racial slurs, the homosexual slurs. I mean, you know, the stereotypes still exist. The poverty that I love the whole opening montage.
Yeah.
The juxtaposition between this disgusting, filthy city, and then you see kind of almost suburbia where people are watering their lawns, they're mm-hmm. swimming in pools.
And that's kind of a Sidney Lumet signature. He likes to do the real New York.
Yeah.
All the gritty, grimy parts of it that, you know, not the pretty Manhattan. It's the griminess of Brooklyn and Queens.
Yeah,
and
you can
the airport.
Smell it. I mean, that was one of the, I mean, you know, and, so I kind of like that juxtaposition too. And then you get it, you know, throughout the movie and just the incompetence of the cops.
Oh,
hysterical.
Yeah. Throughout.
Yeah.
I mean, everything they could have done wrong, they did every time.
Yeah, but even
though
that was
why are those cops across the street looking in here? Oh, we've been caught.
Yeah. Yeah. And I liked the play over and over again about the celebrity. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, even the pizza guy, you know, running off, I'm a star.
Yep.
Because he delivered pizza.
I thought it was on TV.
But that's it. I mean, you know, and we have that today. I mean.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Everybody wants their 15 minutes of fame, or I should say 15 megabytes of fame.
Yeah, anymore.
No, I did think it was the Sonny character. He is kind of a everyday man.
Who's just
kind of a tragic hero because you sit and, I mean, there was no way anything was going to work out well. And, you know, and I love the scene where he's dictating his last will and testament.
Yeah.
To my, you know, my wife, you know, Leon, you know, no man loved another man like I love you, kind of thing. And then he goes, talk about his wonderful wife, Angie. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You know?
Yeah, the dissociance between there is just amazing.
Yeah.
But
Well, and he ended up, I read the real character actually got what was
1% of the royalties.
And he paid for Leon to become a woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who unfortunately later died of AIDS complications in the 80s.
You know, I mean, but, you know, so even after, he still, you know.
Cared enough. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, you know, he took care of his wife, too. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't. I mean, probably just like the will, just, you know, laid it all out. You know, so you really kind of, at least for me as a viewer, I really empathize with the guy. I mean, he was really trying to take care of all the people he loved.
Yeah.
And just couldn't. He couldn't meet and all of their expectations.
It's interesting how, you know, we see his life fall apart here, but his life had been falling apart for a long time. Mm-hmm. A long time. He was obviously gay. Or bisexual, I mean, depending on how you would define it, he identified himself as gay also. I mean, I don't know that bisexual would have been as mainstream. No. And I don't know if it would have been as
and
easy.
In 72, gay was still pretty much a very in the closet secret thing that
you right.
But that's
I thought it was great how they never shied away from that, from the character, and they didn't. You know,
but he never really explained it either.
There were odd questions about it too, because his lover was male but wanted to be female, but he identified himself as loving another man.
Well, and married by
a priest.
I'm assuming it was a Catholic priest.
Well, they said defrocked. Father, and he was defrocked, so that tends me to lead me to believe it was Catholic.
Yeah. You know, and I think that, but I don't think he ever, like, he never came out and called himself a homosexual, where Sal was adamant.
No. I love that.
Wait. You know?
They said there's two guys.
Yeah.
You need to get those guys on the phone and fix that, because that's not right.
You know, and I loved the mouth, the head of the bank tellers. She was classic, you know, New York in my mind, you know. Strong.
Oh, yeah.
Opinionated woman, and so some of her lines just really kind of cracked me up. You know, but I look at it, you could easily do this movie today
mm-hmm.
with modern characters. You could do a vet from Iraq whose life is falling apart, who's struggling with, I mean, all of these.
Yeah,
these
every bit of it, it's all
still rolling.
You know, and then you've got the added, you know, issues with the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember what the economy was like back then. I know.
It was still in 72. We were still going through a recession.
Carter.
Well, no, it didn't. This was still under Nixon. Nixon had kicked at that time. There was a raging inflation going on, and Nixon had just kicked in wage and price controls, which for a Republican is totally out of character, but not out of character for Nixon at the time. We were just coming into the first series of oil shocks.
Yeah.
This economy is already a recession. Seven-day war with Israel and Egypt had just occurred, and we'd just gotten pretty much the first oil embargoes.
So one of the things that I liked about the way the story was told was they flat out told you that he was a vet. Somebody said he was a vet.
He was in Vietnam, yeah.
And actually, he said he was in Vietnam.
Yeah, he identified himself.
And no one ever confirmed it, but they had the scene with him showing one of the tellers how to kick the gun and spin it. Mm-hmm. I love that because it was like, okay, he has some military training. So he wasn't just blowing smoke, because at that point, he was kind of rambling when he said that, because I think it was when he was on the phone one of the times.
Well, he also talked about it when he was yelling at the cops. You know, I know what's going on.
Right.
And you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I liked it that
they told you, but then they gave you something very concrete to show you
the camaraderie until it came out that he was gay.
Right.
And then everything. Yeah, kind of turns on him.
Yeah, it was neat that the tellers were almost supporting him up to that point. Mm-hmm. They had kind of gotten behind him. One, he wasn't treating them badly. He was very considerate. He was very considerate. He was very respectful. And you could see that there was kind of an unspoken, hey, if we go along with this, things are probably going to be okay for us because he seems to be looking out for us.
Well, he was more concerned that the cops would overreact and just, you know, spray the place, irregardless of whether there were hostages in there or not, just to get to him.
Right, right.
Well, but I also thought, I think, you know, the head teller saw, and there was already that undermining of police authority because of Attica and because of other tension just within the community. I think that kind of helped. And again, they were going to be famous. I mean,
true.
You know, and I like the head teller.
The head teller was also. She also kind of put him in his place. The way I saw that character was that he's going to do what he's going to do. So I'm going to tell him what I think we need to get by.
I'm going to take care of my girls.
And if he does something, he's going to do it to me. But I'm going to take care of my girls in the process. And I thought that was awesome of that character. That was a really neat, strong female character in the midst of all of this bizarre. I mean, you had the bizarreness of the bank robbery in the first place, the bizarreness of the police standoff, the bizarreness of having the gay rights group supporting him out there. You know, at the barricade.
Some of the characters in general, I mean, like Sal's haircut.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, just quirky little things. The guy, like
the guy that left.
Yeah,
he's like, I can't do this. Well, give me the keys. What? Give me the keys.
Yeah, we gotta leave us a ride.
How are you gonna get home?
Here's money for the subway. Yeah, that all of that bizarreness, kind of all added to the reality of it, yeah. I think.
Well, it also just lends more to the media circus that it became.
True.
That's everybody true. Is trying, the news is trying to get the story. The cops are trying to get the man. The criminals are trying to just get away. And yeah. they're all trapped with each other. And they can't.
Yeah,
nobody wants to back down.
There was one scene that I'm still not sure. I'm not sure if I like it. And it's not really a scene. It's more of the transition where they kept showing the airport. They kept cutting back to the airport and prepping the plane and getting things ready.
Well, didn't you think it was kind of to build up hope that, oh my God, he's actually gonna pull this off. The little man's actually gonna be okay.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know if I liked that or not. You know, it seemed really weird as I was watching it, and even now thinking about it, I don't know. I don't know. And see, that's just it. I'm not really sure what I feel about it, but it just struck me as odd, and it just kind of left me off kilter, and maybe that was.
If that's part of the point, then it did
what it was supposed to.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. He started to cry when he got off the phone. He was so frustrated. Got off the phone with his wife, controlled himself and stopped. And then at the end, you see tears when he sees Sal's body. And I thought that was a nice piece of direction.
Yeah,
I really. And that was the thing I liked about Al Pacino. And when I saw this movie when I was working, I got a job for my tennis coach working in a media lab for a local college. And we didn't have much to do. It was in the summer, so I worked with a whole bunch of college guys, and then the media director would just say, well, here, have you seen this movie? And we put it on. And these were on the old, not the VHS, the...
Laserdisc?
No, we had Laserdisc, but then...
Oh, VHS?
No, it was the other...
Beta. Betas.
And so we had this huge collection with the rolling rack, and this was one of the movies that was suggested, and I kind of went on this tear through Pacino movies, Serpico and all these. And that was one of the things I loved about his acting, is that... Just you could see the roller coaster of emotions without him saying anything.
Yeah.
And then when he is yelling, I mean, you can see the spit on his lips, and it's just it came across as really authentic. Mm-hmm. And you were mesmerized by it. I mean,
the actor has just pulled. He has submerged himself into the character.
Yeah,
he comes off as one of those actors that always seems very, very intelligent. Just you can see that he's always thinking. There's always something going on in his mind, and I think that even looking at the opening scenes in Godfather, really when he's leaning back and taking everything in and kind of half talking to, can't remember what her name is, Talia Shire's character, his wife, the one who ends up being his wife.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just the way he's taking it all in, you can, I mean, his eyes are showing you just how much he's thinking it.
Well, it's so subtle.
Yeah.
I mean, and looking at how his character connected to, particularly Sal, that relationship was really interesting. And they didn't give you much on, you know, how do they know each other. Obviously, Leon knew about him, but then they don't ever flesh out why did he bring Sal, you know, and how
right.
does he know. But yet, he cared about Sal, he cared about Sal's well-being, and it was more than just being worried about Sal getting them into more trouble.
Right.
You know, like the whole the bond of, if we don't get out clean, we're going to kill ourselves.
Right.
You know, I wish they had gone into a little bit more of that in the beginning.
But
yet, I can also understand why he didn't want to play that up.
Without saying it out loud, the feel I got from Sal was that he was either like a high school buddy or somebody that he knew from maybe childhood even, or he was somebody that he served with.
Yeah, that's why I was guessing that,
it was more the Vietnam connection, but I could also see him because he kind of had the New York vibe to Sal. Sal was, I mean, his name is Sal,
yeah,
and he's got the accent and everything.
Religious, I mean, at least in terms of, you know, my body is my temple, kind
right?
of thing. But you didn't find anything in the reading you did on the relationship between those two characters, did you?
In the real life version?
Yeah.
No, the real life version is the two were completely opposite. Sal was just a small time hoodlum, that he just happened to pick up because I guess he knew the hole in the end of the gun is that away. He had been in prison many times for small petty crimes. He'd never done anything this big. But, you gotta remember the real life character that Sonny played was 18 years old. At the time,
I thought Leon was 18, and not Sonny. What was his original name?
It was Sonny.
Sal's character.
Sal. Sal's character.
Lena's in the chat room saying the original guy was only 18. Sal's mm-hmm. character.
Right. So he was,
Sal had even made mention of not wanting to go back. I'm not mm-hmm. going to go back there. I'm not going to go back.
Well, he'd already been in prison several times.
If he was only 18, the original people, mm-hmm. if he was only 18, yeah, they would not have had a probably wouldn't have had a connection, at least not militarily.
No. No, the character that's played in the movie is in his late 30s.
Right.
But, yes, he met the same unfortunate end as the character in the movie.
Yeah, and Sonny's real name is John.
No, I
enjoyed it. I mean, it was one of my, other than Godfather, it was one of my first introductions when I was younger to Al Pacino.
Yeah.
And obviously I'd seen John Cazale in Godfather as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think going back, one of the standouts was seeing...
There's one other interesting juxtaposition in this movie. All through the movie we see Sonny. He gets more and more disheveled. As he's being more and more, his cage is being rattled. Sal, he's always got his suit and his tie on. He doesn't seem to be bothered by the heat, and he's always rather immaculately dressed.
Well, Sal also doesn't ever go outside.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but the air conditioner is off. I mean, the lead teller, when she's
That's
taking
true.
The notation, she's got her blouse undone. All you see is her slip.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
You know, so they're all getting sweaty. So you're right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the common collected, not common collected by appearance. But yet, inside, Sal was, you know.
Pretty stable. I mean, he was the only cool character there. But you know, the time is they're constantly, the cops are constantly rattling Sonny the fact, well, he can't be trusted.
Well, I think Sonny, it was not so much he can't be trusted, it was he's wrestling with all of these priorities and this, mm-hmm. this sense of I need to take care of all of this stuff and responsibility, where Sal didn't have any responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Other than just, yes, being there.
Yeah.
And
asking a couple of questions that kind of kept things.
What's interesting about the people around Sonny is Sonny took on a role of wanting to take care of them.
The father role.
But every one of them said, you don't need to do this. You never needed to do this for me. Leon said it. His wife, Angie, said it. His mother said it. They all referenced, you know, he's doing this. He thinks he's doing
this
for...
He's being a man.
But he is being a man. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean,
But they also all referenced, you know, what is he doing? Why is he doing this? You know, he thinks he's doing this for me. He didn't need to go this far. He didn't need to do this. But he's stepping up and he's being the man. So it was interesting that none of them thought that he needed to do it, but he very much took it upon himself that he had to take care of all these people.
Yep. He's trying to be the responsible father.
Right. And I think what's interesting is that for him doing this, he wasn't pressured by any of those outside forces to do this, to rob a bank, to get this sum of money, to do this. It was a burden that he took on himself to take this risk, to do this, to provide for these people.
Just a couple more things about the director, Sidney Lumet. He was noted pretty much for being a rapid fire director. He barely did more than one or two takes. In fact, this whole movie was done in pretty much record time for a movie of this era. He got his start essentially in TV production. He was one of the first directors who moved out of TV direction into movie direction. And his rapid-fire directorial skills plied him well in the movie business, because he was really noted for bringing movies in on time and on budget, and also getting the best performance out of the actors he worked with. Because he was an actor at one point, he got his start in theater and then moved into the direction business. So he understood essentially the technical language of all actors. And actors who worked with him really appreciated that.
I can see a movie like this also being one where, yeah, you can have a script, but if there's a little bit of improvisation on things like when he's on the phone and, mm-hmm. you know, monologuing, that if he improvises a little bit, it's probably not bad.
Well,
especially from somebody like...
was noted for being very open to taking input from all the cast and crew about the way shots could be done. He wasn't a dictator, it's my way or nowhere. He was very open to different ideas.
Right. And I'm sure as long as they hit the points of what the scene was trying to come across, mm-hmm. if they didn't get their lines exactly perfect, it's not like anybody was going to, you know, really have a major problem with it. This is, mm-hmm. yeah, it was a real event, but they didn't take it. They didn't take word for word dialogue. They didn't, you know,
their script was more of a set of guidelines.
Right. And even the character names weren't the same mm-hmm. as the actual people. Mm-hmm. They were slightly different.
Right. Well, this thing is not a documentary.
I think it's a
drama.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was funny how much they anglicized Sonny's last name, because mm-hmm. his last name is very ethnic.
Yes.
It's, in fact, I think they cut two, maybe three syllables off of his last name. I think it's a great movie. I really do.
Yeah, it's worth your time. It's worth your time to sit down and watch it at least once in a while.
Yeah.
I agree.
For the performances and for the story. Mm-hmm. I think the story, you know, as you guys were saying before, the story is still very relevant. And
right, you can make the same movie today using different characters.
Yeah.
Or in setting a different location and using different characters with maybe slightly different motivations, but it would still all be relevant.
Right, and then before you do, watch Chris Sarandon in anything else, and then watch this. And it's like,
what happened?
Whoa. Whoa.
Yeah.
Well, one last thing on Sully Lumet. He actually published a book on how to make movies. In fact, you can get it on Amazon. It's called Making Movies, which is all of his, which is, he writes essentially down all the things it takes to make a movie. Nice. It is kind of considered a definitive textbook for anybody who's into film.
Very cool.
You can pick it up for $7 on Amazon.
Fantastic. Anything else?
Nope.
We good?
Pretty much covered.
Yeah, all right. Great. So next week we're going to discuss the original Friday the 13th. We may even release on a different day than normal because July actually does have a Friday the 13th. I may, depending on timing of things, I may try to get that out, that episode out. Instead of Monday the 16th, I guess it is, would be when it would normally drop, I might try to slip in a little early and get it actually in on Friday the 13th. So, if not, it'll be on the 16th, but next week, Friday the 13th, the original.
Yes, the original John Carpenter version.
Yes. All right. That's all. See you guys next week.
Thank you for showing up.